This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Want you to contact us, so get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to this extra episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today we bring you this extra episode all the way from Egypt, and we're featuring a story we hope you will find fascinating. I'm joined by Eddie Gold, co-founder and general manager at General Aviation Support Egypt, an aircraft maintenance engineer and now helping people fly around the world in general aviation aircraft and helicopters. Eddie, welcome to Extended.
Thank you, Peter. Good to be here.
Now, Eddie, where exactly are we talking to you from? I know the line's got a bit of a crackle on it, so people will know you're not in the studio with me.
Yeah, I'm in my apartment in a place called Masakan Sheraton, which is a district of Cairo. We're about half a kilometre from the end of runway 05 left at Cairo International Airport.
Right, okay. Well, we're going to come back to Egypt, but before we talk about that, let's talk a little bit about your background. You've got an accent there that suggests you're from the northwest of England. How did you get into aviation?
Well, yeah, you caught on quick. I'm originally from Liverpool. I left Liverpool when I was 18, but my early years, my father was Army Regimental Sergeant Major in the end, and we travelled here, there and everywhere.
Right.
Mainly bases in the UK. But one place we were stationed was a place called Stockbridge in Hampshire, and it was close to Middle Wallop.
Yeah.
And we used to go, and my dad used to take me when I was 3 years old to watch the aircraft. And the thing I remember mainly from those early years was being on the South Downs with a picnic, watching Peter Twiss fly the Fairey Delta over 1,000 miles an hour.
Wow.
And my dad was drumming into me how important this was and how British ingenuity had created the aircraft to fly faster than 1,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And it looked good as well.
Right? Yeah, you know? I bet.
That stuck with me. My dad bought me bought me a frog model of the Fairey Delta.
Yeah.
And I had that for many years. And when I was able to, I was buying Airfix models and books on aircraft. And it just kind of like stuck with me.
Yeah.
My two brothers were both in the Army. My dad was in the Army. So they probably thought I was destined for the RAF. It's that kind of thing. So when he retired from the Army, we moved back to Liverpool, and I spent my formative years in Liverpool and went through the grammar school system, working my way to A-levels. But instead of going to university, I was offered a job as an aircraft maintenance engineer at Keenair at Liverpool Airport.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which was then called It was called Speak Airport back then.
And, yeah, I was there a week or so ago in Speak, right next to the airport, so I know what you mean. Aircraft maintenance got you, I suppose, in the hangar, as it were. What did that lead to?
Well, it was. It didn't lead to much, really, except I learned stuff, obviously, and I got to hang around with pilots and other engineers. I mainly got to be close to aircraft, which was my dream.
Yeah.
And little things like, there's still I can still smell having my sandwiches for lunch sitting in a stomp biplane. Just because I could.
Yeah. And did you get the opportunity to fly in many of them at the time?
Yes. I kind of like was offered flying lessons as part of my wages, so I never used to pick a lot of money up. But I did get to fly an hour each week in a Piper Colt.
Right, okay.
And we had an Apache, which we used to fly on charter services, air taxi services, and I'd be taken along to act as almost a doorman. You know, I'd open doors and show people out and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And our main fleet was PA-28s, and we would fly them to Barton in Manchester for their main overhauls and stuff. We weren't equipped for major overhauls, and we'd fly there, park the aircraft at Barton, leave them behind, and then get a lift back in our Apache, which would follow us.
Right, okay.
So it was really an enthusiast dream.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much I learned as a mechanic from there. I did get to paint the hangar, though.
Yeah.
Now, a job in the hall.
Just to get things right, you're no longer a aircraft maintenance technician, are you?
No, that was a long time ago.
Yeah. But you did do a bit of flying. Did you proceed through to any of your licenses? I know you've done a bit of gliding as well.
Yeah, I've done gliding with the ATC. I know a lot of cadets do that. That was done at Sealand. Chipmunks were the air experience flights at the time.
Yeah.
And then we had a Cessna 150, which I would do my flying lessons. And I use the word flying lessons kind of basically as part payment for my services during the time I was there that never actually took me to any levels other than sitting in the seat, being given general ideas of how to do a circuit. And that was about it.
Yeah.
But it did give me the incentive to look further, except this period, 1970, 1971, was not a good period for Liverpool.
No.
It's the start of that recession that ended in a three-day week and everything. And the Northwest was hit bad, and people stopped taking flying lessons, and I was made redundant. It was a sad day because it was Boxing Day. I only had Christmas Day off.
Gosh.
I turned up for work Boxing Day, and he says, "Now we've got to get rid of you, the other mechanic, and one of the pilots."
Wow, Merry Christmas.
Yeah. So it was a case of trying to work out what to do next. And the same was happening with my parents, who were directors of a company, and that went bust. So they decided to move back to my father's hometown, which was in the Midlands, in a place called Willenhall. In Walsall, not the Coventry one. And I followed them down and started working in manufacturing here, just because it was still a thriving area for manufacturing. This led to going into actual precision engineering, and which led to working in companies in the aerospace industry, engineering components for Airbus, British Aerospace, Westland. So, and I used to be able to visit the factories, and that it all kept the aviation theme going and allowed me to start thinking about taking flying lessons.
Yeah.
Oh, you know the words, in life you can make wrong choices. It's happened a few times, and I was always stop-start, getting 5 hours here and then missing 10 years and getting starting again and getting 5 hours. And
yeah.
And I even tried flex wing micro lighting up at in Splundle.
Okay. Yeah.
That again was just 5 hours, and then I had a major accident, not in an aircraft, away from aviation, which gave me inner ear damage.
Right.
The inner ear damage is what I suffer from now, more commonly known as vertigo or vertigo, which means that if I come off my medication, I immediately go into a 6G spin. It's a horrible thing to have, and it just knocked flying on the head or any thought of flying. I can't even drive a car.
Okay, so how does the story then take you to the part of the world that you're in now?
The way things went after that accident was a case of moving around. I was doing jobs here, there. I run a few businesses, nothing to do with aviation. Didn't like them. Tried various jobs away from anything heavy. And then I got back into engineering in a town called Atherston in Warwickshire. We're doing rotor housings for the Merlin for Westland, and yep, that was brilliant.
Yeah.
And then 9 months later, I was made redundant from there. And then I went to another engineering firm, and just over a year later, I was made redundant from there.
Gosh.
It was people wouldn't work with me because they knew the factory would go down the drain.
Yeah. And it must have felt like the world of aviation wasn't doing you any favours.
No, I have a rosy view of aviation, so it's always like I'd rather blame myself for my predicament by making the wrong choices than thinking that aviation's not being good to me.
Okay.
Because somebody designed an aircraft, and I look at that aircraft and I get pleasure.
Yeah.
It's great to be into aviation in any way. I mean, all the way along, I used to make models. I used to be an aircraft spotter of sorts and a photographer of aircraft.
Right.
And I travel the country spending many weekends, sometimes weeks at airfields when I had the time. And we even had a caravan at Mildenhall.
Wow.
At the end of the runway.
Wow.
Because my brother was the same. We would go all over the place.
Yeah. Okay.
And, I mean, there's no regrets. Well, maybe a few. Hold on, it sounds like I'm about to start singing. It's what you make of it. And
yeah.
I really now know that if I'd have took a different route, what I do now would not have existed.
Yeah.
So happy the way things have worked out.
How did you get to Egypt?
Well, I'd met a girl, a lady, in one of my other passions, which is trivia quizzing.
Okay.
I run a number of quiz teams. I run an international quiz team. We're generally in the top five in the world.
All right, so, okay. Now, I didn't know that about you, I must say.
On this international quiz site, I met a lady who had as her own hometown Warwick, and I lived not far from Warwick, so I started chatting to her.
Yeah.
And it turned out in the end that she didn't live in Warwick, she was born there. She now lived in Cairo in Egypt. And I go, wow, you know, that's amazing. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, she's a teacher in an international school in Cairo. Then we got to know each other and met up. And over the period of this, it was decided that she would leave Cairo and come and stay with me in Atherston. And at the same, just after that was decided, I was made redundant. So
right.
I'm going, oh, no.
Yeah.
And she just said, well, why don't you come to Egypt? And I think I mulled it over for about 2 seconds and went, yeah, go on, I'll come in.
Yeah.
And that's how it happened. I came over here, and that was in 2008, and for the first 2 years, I generally enjoyed looking at Egypt because everything here is so crazy.
Yeah.
Taking photos, posting on Facebook. We moved apartment from where Anthea had originally lived. Anthea's my wife, by the way.
Yeah.
I moved to an apartment very close to the end of runway 05 in Cairo. From my window, I could just sit there and watch the airliners and military aircraft fly past my window, taking photos. So I started making albums about it, and people would like my albums, comment on them, and then Egyptians started liking them. I'd already found out that there was really no aviation enthusiast scene here, but there are closeted aviation enthusiasts who don't really like to brag about it because you're liable to get locked up.
You know? Yeah, is it illegal? Is it illegal in that part of the world to spot and that sort of thing, or is it just the general security?
Yeah. I've been arrested for aircraft spotting, and we've been approached by Secret Service with guns out, asking what we're doing. And this was just taking pictures of 737s landing at the runway.
Yeah. And and how much of an effect is that of the recent troubles? Is it still like that, or is it much tighter?
The times I was arrested, it was before the revolution in 2011.
Right.
It was even before GASE.
Right.
I was just here enjoying taking photos of the aircraft.
Yeah.
And that was when President Mubarak was in power, and he had set up emergency powers 30 years before, and they were still in place. So the whole place was paranoid.
Yeah.
I was taking these photos, putting them on Facebook, and the Egyptian enthusiast started to contact me and say, oh, I love your photos and that. And one guy called Ahmed, he got in touch when one event happened, and that was the arrival of President Obama in 2009 on Air Force One. We both apparently posted videos of Air Force One arriving. I was taking photos, my wife was taking the video, and we put that on Facebook at the same time as this Egyptian guy called Ahmed put his video on. We were the only two in Egypt who'd actually posted anything about it, so we found out we lived close enough and started chatting a lot about aviation. So it was the arrival of President Obama that created the friendship that would lead to GASE.
Now, this is Ahmed Hassan, isn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
He was, and still is, massively embroiled in aviation in Egypt and elsewhere, because he went through an FDA education system here that bases itself on learning English or a foreign language.
Yeah.
So he went to a language school, and then he went to university to learn tourism, which he didn't like, and then went to the Egyptian Aviation Academy to become a flight dispatcher.
Okay.
Ahmed can't fly himself because of restrictions through his medical conditions, which are based around diabetes.
Right, okay.
So he took the route to go into flight dispatching.
Yeah, okay.
So what we have here brewing up is one British guy with the knowledge, experience of working in a place where general aviation is quite normal and it's fun and everybody involved loves the pastime. And we have an Egyptian who would love to have that experience, but instead has had to go the official way, but has learned a lot and is now deeply embroiled in the bureaucracy of flight planning, permits, and things like that.
I can feel the spark coming, Eddie.
Yeah. And this is a sad bit. In, I think it was late 2009, a guy in the UK asked if we could help a microlight pilot who was flying around the world. Or no, he might have been flying to Australia. And he was due to land in Cairo. And me and Ahmed said, yeah, we'll help. What do you want us to do? He said, we'll just show him around and things like that. And we said, well, yeah, no problem. This guy was called Martin Bromarge, and sadly, he never got across the channel. He died in, he crashed in fog over the channel and didn't survive. But a few months later, the same guy called us and says, do you want to try it again? We says, yeah. He says, well, we've got a guy called Norman Surplus flying a autogyro around the world, and he'll be coming to October Airport, which is out in the desert, about 30 miles west of Cairo.
And we says, these two stories start off with the ringing in my head that says, mad dogs and Englishmen. Microlights flying around the world and auto gyros trying to fly around the world. It would have been nice if somebody said, I'm flying in my, I don't know, PA-28 or a bizjet or something. You certainly started off with some tricky challenges, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, we never actually had to do anything for Martin, but the thing was, we were naive. We knew of the airport, not been there, and we knew that flying in Egypt was probably not the same as flying in Europe. But we were ready to meet Norman on arrival. And he arrived 6th of April 2010. It was our 7th anniversary a few days ago. He arrived, we met him, and then the fun started. Luckily, Ahmed, speaking the language, because nobody at that airport speaks English, luckily Ahmed was able to help Norman get through the craziness. I mean, Norman had cleared customs at Alexandria. This general aviation airport in the desert outside Cairo had more security and more checkpoints to go through and passports to be seen and sit down for half an hour while we look at your papers kind of thing. A top international airport, which seems stupid. Mm. Because we were generally there to help him get out the airport and then look after him while he was in Cairo, most of the other stuff had been done by the flight clearance company that he had hired to do his flight.
Yeah.
It's based in the UK, but I don't want to mention names or anything. And the company had sent them to a handling agency in Cairo who were charging him $600 a stop. And me and Ahmed says, how much? And he says, yeah, we had to pay $600. That's not airport fees, that's handling fees. And we're going, that's got to be wrong. He says, no. Here's the, showed us the invoices. And anyway, it was a lot of hassle at the airport. And me and Ahmed were going, what's happening here? Or maybe it was me going, because I'm going, I used to go to Hapney Green. I used to go to Woodvale. I used to go to all these lovely general aviation airfields where you can just walk in, have a walk around the hangar, talk to the pilots. Here, you've dared to land in our country in a general aviation aircraft. You must be a criminal, and we're going to charge you through the nose for having the gall to come and land an aircraft here. It seemed so ridiculous that in the end, we were just happy to get him in the car and out the airport.
Yeah.
We'd arranged media, and they weren't allowed on. They were stopped at the security gate and turned away.
Okay.
So with a phone call, we ended up having a press conference at McDonald's down the road.
As one does.
But it certainly opened our eyes. And but over the next few days, Norman had a great time. We showed him the pyramids and things like that. And took him out on the night. He enjoyed the social scene, and he was really happy with it. And then we took him back to the airport watcher, and he was due to depart at 9 o'clock local time in the morning. And the bureaucracy, the stubbornness and the stupidity at the airport meant that he was lining up for departure at midday, 12 o'clock. And then we watched him turn round and come back. He'd worked out with the winds that he would not reach his door before sunset because they had held him up so long. So we had an extra day with him. And the following day, Ahmed took over and just argued with everybody, shouted at people, got pieces of paper stamped quicker, and Norman managed to get away in time, and still only just. But it's it was that kind of thing in the end that Ahmed says, if I hadn't been there pushing these people, Norman wouldn't have got away again.
Yeah.
All these little things were creating the spark of an idea. Anyway, Norman took off, carried on to Luxor, and for the rest of his flight, we became involved in to the extent that I was given the job of running his social media pages, his blog, his Facebook page, his website. And Ahmed, through his contacts, was finding people to look after him in different parts of the world. And Norman was very grateful, so much so that he told his supporters back in the UK about us. And then we got people sending us messages saying, we've heard what Norman says, now we'd like to do something similar, but we'd like you to look after us. Is that possible?
Well, Eddie, let's just hold that thought there. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to carry on with the JASE journey after we've heard this.
Not another flying magazine. The news agents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
So, Eddie, before the break there, we heard about your first trials and tribulations in helping somebody get a GA aircraft through Egypt. What happened next?
Well, following the requests from the pilots in the UK saying that they liked what they heard about what we'd done and would like to do something similar but would like to have us look after them, me and Ahmed got together and decided that we could do this. And we talked about it and came up with a remit that we stick to the present day, which is that we be non-profit, offer better services, cheaper prices and memorable experiences. And that's how we set ourselves up.
Eddie, let me just ask you one question about. I've got a load of questions, but the first one: why non-profit? Very commendable, but I just want to understand a little bit around that, because it has a lot to do with the ethos that you've got at General Aviation Support Egypt, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, if you remember, that originally our aim was Egypt, to get people into Egypt and out of Egypt. Now, airport fees, handling fees are really expensive. Anybody who's been flying around Europe and then they cross the Med and their first stop is Egypt will be shocked by how much they have to pay. So our main aim was to bring the price down. And we weren't going to bring the price down by charging a fortune for our services. And being enthusiasts, we were enthusiastically happy to do it. It's I get asked all the time by pilots, well, why do you do it for no profit? And I says, well, I'm 64. Most places I'd be retired. And when you're retired, you take up a hobby. A lot of people take up golf. I don't like golf. I like aircraft. So this is my hobby.
Wow.
Any other hobby, I'd be spending a fortune on. This one, I can do 24/7, be happy with the outcome, and get to meet pilots and their aircraft and be part of their adventures. When I know that medically I cannot do it myself, it's a way of being part of something, getting pleasure and enjoyment, and extending my lifetime hobby into something that helps others as well. So,
how does your partner feel about that though? Because he's had a career and it's a tricky area. He obviously has to work hard like you. It's very commendable of you both.
Well, with Ahmed, he's has a day job. He is a top-notch flight dispatcher. He's been headhunted a few times by different airlines. And he works...
Wow.
He's in Dubai now, working for Fly Dubai.
Right, okay.
He's worked in Georgia, Saudi Arabia, and for a number of airlines in Egypt. And he's just at the top of his game. So he is self-sufficient as a flight dispatcher. And he does GASE as his hobby. I don't want to make anybody think that the word hobby means we're less than professional. It's the exact opposite, because we care. You know, it's...
See, Eddie, I'm looking at your website. I've got my tablet in front of me, and it's scrolling through your pages. I'm seeing an R-66. I'm looking at a Spanish aircraft on a round-the-world trip. I'm looking at a 2017 Serengeti Rally. You've got a German flight flying across from Germany and around the world, Cessna 152. I mean, these are quite monumental projects that you're supporting here.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
So tell me, Eddie, what is it that you provide for these flights that come through? Because I've been following you for a while. We've talked a couple of times over the past year or so. I've been watching mainly your Facebook page, just because it's easy. And I see monumental achievement week after week going through there of somebody either flying around the world or making some very long journey in a small aircraft. What is it that you do for them?
Our basic remit is that we offer cheaper prices with better services in the safest way. And we offer it by two guys who will inevitably become your friend, because that's the way we work, and that's what's happened 100% up to now.
So tell me about some of these flights. What do you actually do? Do you get involved in the flight planning? I know you do a lot of groundwork. You ferry a lot of people around, you collect them, you organise their hangarage. What's involved in things like flight planning across that part of the world's airspace?
Well, generally, we get a request comes through either the website or Facebook page, and it's saying, I'm planning on doing this next year. Can you help me? And then we go into action. We tell them what we can do and then ask them what they think they can do. Then we tell them what they can't do and tell them what we suggest they should do.
Yeah.
Which is generally, they'll pick up an atlas and go, here's my route. And then when you look at the route, you go, well, there's no AVGAS there. That's not an airport of entry. That country will shoot you down. Here's what we suggest. And then we explain why we've picked the airports, including the ones where members of our GASE family are, who will then volunteer and give them...
They're not just in Egypt, though, are they, Eddie? Your wings spread a little further.
Yeah, it's become, what's the word, is it morphic? Amorphic?
It's morphed into something much bigger than you ever thought.
Yeah. People contact us and say, we love what you're doing, we'd like to be part of it. If you have pilots flying to our airport, we're going to do this. I mean, today we have the R-66 going around the world. He arrives in Cairo on Wednesday. Peter Wilson.
Yeah.
And
beautiful helicopter.
Somebody in the yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
Yeah, he flew all around Africa last year in it solo, so
wow.
It's got some miles on it. And this evening I had a message from a lady in Nantucket who said, I'm loving this journey. Are they coming to Nantucket? And I said, yes, I put them straight in the schedule that they've got to visit Nantucket, because Betsy in Nantucket is a secretary of the flying club there, and she runs a summer camp for aviation-minded kids. and they will arrive in the middle of the summer camp, so they will become heroes.
Yeah.
And the flying club, who we class as part of our network, will have a club dinner where they will eat for free, and they will get sightseeing, go on yachts and all that kind of thing, because it's a big yachting place. It's Norman loved it there. He was there for a week. And that's just one. But all the way along any of the routes that we choose, we have the same kind of people spread out who will do amazing things to be part of anybody's adventure.
And these are all really big adventures. And I've just mentioned a few that are very current. What's been your most challenging flight? They all look pretty tricky to me. It doesn't look like one simple one, but what's your most challenging one?
With this, I suppose me and Ahmed would differ. The most challenging one for me was the flight of Icarus. That was Icarus C-42 Microlight.
Yep.
The flew from Goodwood to Cape Town and back. And they decided to do that maybe a month, 2 months before they actually set off.
Wow.
So there was very little planning and very naive about what the rest of the world would be like. And they were told by other companies that do the same stuff as us that it was impossible because they had a 300 nautical mile range.
Yeah.
And they contacted us, and I says, yeah, no problem, I'll do it. Mainly because we'd had a lot of successes, and Ahmed said to me, it's going to be a hard one. He says, why did you say we'd do it? And I say, well, we'll sort some out.
There's a Scouser coming out in you there, Eddie.
Yeah. And it was amazing. I took over the routing, and I found airfields here, there, and everywhere. And it's sometimes my naivety from back then came into play. They were going, where next, Eddie? Well, I found a place called Lubumbashi. It's just over the Congo border. And they says, okay. And they got there, and they were using MoGas, so they had a lift into town. And he says, oh, it's scary. Everybody's giving us funny looks. I was watching a documentary the other day, and Lubumbashi is the mayor, the capital of Congo.
Oh, God, yeah.
No expats, no foreigners. And I said, these two guys, they're like, you know. Well, but it was all parts of the adventure. They enjoyed it, like, you know.
And it doesn't always go well, does it, Eddie? I've seen some stories, and you've mentioned a few offline to me, where things get really, really challenging. And without casting any aspersions on any involved, tell us about things like getting stuck in the middle of the Sudan with no fuel.
Yeah, the Tiger Moth there. This was Johan Wiklund, a Swedish pilot with Scandinavian Airline System, who decided to commemorate the achievement of a Swedish pilot from the 1920s who flew a Tiger Moth from Norway to Cape Town. And he decided to do the same. He had I think it was a 1932 de Havilland Moth. I apologise, I was calling it a Tiger Moth. How did I? That's terrible. It's a de Havilland Moth, okay. And it was original instruments. The only technology he had was an iPad. There was no brakes, no lights, and his speedometer was a spring-loaded bar on the main strut that, when you flew along, the wind would move it along a graduated scale to tell you how fast you've gone.
Oh, my goodness.
And he had to land in the dark at Cairo Airport, and he used the lights from his iPad to see what speed he was doing because he was so dark.
And Eddie, for something like that, a de Havilland Moth flying into Cairo, you know, that's international airspace, isn't it? All around there, is there not issues with the aviation authorities for that sort of thing?
He wasn't supposed to go there. He was supposed to come to our airport,
right?
And the typical bureaucracy of the CAA and all that, made him fly a route that was not the best one that anybody would pick. This made him late for our airport, which closes at sunset, and the traffic controller wouldn't let him go direct. And in the end, they said, you have to divert to Cairo International. He's going, Amity Haviland Moth. No, you have to divert to Cairo International. We were at this other airport, and we were going, where's he going? And he says, he's going to Cairo International. Now, trying to get across Cairo in the traffic at around sunset is like trying to swim through wet cement.
Yeah,
it's slow, and I'm going, oh. And I was passing messages because we had to rearrange for handlers to meet him, because we hadn't we do the handling at our airport, and we kept phoning up saying, tell him not to leave the airport, keep him in hall 4, we'll pick him up, we're about half an hour away, that kind of thing. He still wasn't in hall 4. I'm saying, where is he? Oh, he's okay, he'll be coming soon. This went on for an hour. Then we found out he'd been arrested as a spy.
Oh my gosh.
He had GoPro cameras on the wing struts, and even though they weren't working, somebody noticed them and arrested him. Nobody knew why he'd arrived there, because the powers that be in air traffic control hadn't told the people on the ground, and nobody was believing our handlers that he was a diversion, and they questioned him for 30 hours.
Wow.
Of course, me and Ahmed were doing everything we could outside. I was at the airport from 7 o'clock in the evening till 3 o'clock, waiting for him to come out, and they decided to say, you can't stop here, he's not coming out, we'll look after him. And next day was the same. Eventually got out half one in the morning, took him to the hotel, and the first thing he said was, get me a beer quick. And you may have seen a photo of him with his first beer. He looks as though he's just run a marathon.
He's got
this cold beer in his hand, and it looks like something out of Ice Cold in Alex.
Now, I also know that you got involved with some security services as well. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, this flight was going south, and with his short range, we had a problem, because Ethiopia had closed down all its entry airports on the Sudanese border. This meant he had to fly from Damazin in the east of Sudan all the way to Lokichogio in the north of Kenya. Too far, so he needed to land somewhere and top up with fuel from a jerry can. Now, the bit in between where he would need to land is called South Sudan. And if any people who don't know, it's actually a war zone, and a very hot war zone. It's people get shot at and killed. It's not a nice place to land. But we were planning on, hopefully, he would drop below radar, cross into the Ethiopian border, and find somewhere to land to top up. The Flight of Icarus guys did this. They landed in the bush, so it was quite possible. And then we got a message from Johan when he was at Damazin, saying that he'd met a crew, an American crew, Canadian or Australian. He says they were a mixture. He said they were flying a Cessna Caravan, and they gave him instructions to land in the town, gave him the coordinates, and he says, great. They also says, don't ever tell anybody who we are, the registration of our aircraft, or that we told you what to do. And we're going, ooh, wonder what's going on here. Anyway, he landed. It was near enough, right on the border with Ethiopia, and it's rebel-held territory. The strip was like a main street in a tiny shanty town. By a main street, we mean like it was just ground. It was no tarmac or anything. The street was lined with all the residents who were looking down to the ground. There were armed people keeping the residents off the street, and he landed. Nobody came to meet him. He got out, refueled. Nobody came close. Got back in and took off. He said it was the weirdest experience he'd ever known. And it's of course, our imaginations were going all over the place, like, you know, what on earth happened there? Then he popped up onto Ethiopian radar again, said, sorry, my transponder went off.
And so they were never heard of again, this ghost crew?
I've got it located on my Google Earth. It's nothing. There seems to be no roads in or out, and it's very a weird place. We haven't put it on our list of must visits.
Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Eddie, tell me a bit about some of the flights you're managing and have recently managed. Because, as I said, I've been on the Facebook quite a lot recently and you're popping up with some fantastic flights. Tell us about a few that are on the go at the moment. Who's up to what?
Yeah, we've got a air van. Have you ever heard of an air van? It's,
yes.
I think it's Australian built. It's like the version of the Cessna Caravan.
Very strong, very good aircraft, actually.
We got one of them being ferried from Australia to Poland with three Polish pilots.
How do you get over some? Do you have language problems? I mean, because again, looking at your website, there's some interesting nationalities passing through.
Yeah, it's true. Luckily, English is the language of aviation, so
so you're safe.
It's safe, you know.
What will you be providing to the to that crew, the air van, in terms of their transiting?
Well, they're not coming to Egypt, so it's generally we provided route planning, arranging, handling, fuel, accommodation, and mainly permits.
And how much that journey do you cover, Eddie? Part of it? What particular parts of their journey do you cover? All of it?
We've done everything from their departure from Australia to Romania. They've said, we know the way from Romania. So
I suppose what I was looking to tease out is this just isn't Egypt or even just Africa for you, is it? You cover flights from every part of the globe.
Yeah, at one time we at the start it was just Egypt, trying to make it pleasant for people to come to Egypt. Now Egypt is probably, arrivals in Egypt are down to maybe 10% of what we do.
Yeah.
Last week we arranged for a British pilot in America to fly to Cuba, spend a week in Cuba.
Right.
And that came out the blue. We had two Russian R-66s fly from Moscow to Morocco, and one carried on to Mauritania and then to the Canary Isles and back. And four Russian pilots and two R-66s, Moscow to Japan to New Zealand, and then back to Moscow via Australia, Indonesia, India, Middle East.
I can just imagine your office wall with a big map on it and all the pictures of all these amazing flights you've done. I mean, just on their own, they're quite spectacular.
Yeah, it's each year we've grown exponentially, and last year we had five round-the-world flights, and we thought, amazing. This year we've got round-the-world flights happening nearly every week of the year. There'll be somebody flying around the world.
And Eddie, is it because it can be done? Is it because people are pushing the envelope? What's the increase in? Why are you seeing such an increase? I mean, it's fantastic for the work you do. And for me as an enthusiast, it's amazing to see this happen. I'm just flabbergasted. You know, Moscow to the Canary Islands. This is fantastic in a helicopter. But, you know, why are we seeing such a boom in these sorts of flights, do you think?
Social media. It's got to be.
Okay.
In the past, when I was younger, you'd see a book in a bookshop or a air show in the bookstalls, and you'd go, oh, somebody's flew around the world, let's read that. Oh, that's a great adventure. You know, it wouldn't hit you to do it yourself. But now people on social media are seeing so many people flying long distances in vans, RV8s and RV6s and stuff. Even small helicopters going around the world. And anybody who owns a mid-range Piper will go, I can do that. And if you've got a Mooney, you can go around the world 10 times. Like, you know.
So Eddie, then, bit of advice for people listening in. What are the sorts of things that if someone's contemplating, let's just say a trip from the UK to Australia, for example, what are the sorts of things that they have to start thinking about now, and where do you guys step in?
We step in when somebody approaches us. They will ask if we can help, and we say we certainly can, but we need some information, and we will be asking for a type of aircraft, whether it's certificates of airworthiness or permit to fly, or what kind of certification it has, type of fuel, safe range, and we'd say something like, have you got any suggestions already for what you want to do? Type of flights. I mean, there's many different types of flights, charity flights, record-breaking flights, ferry or leisure flights. And we'll ask how many crew, nationalities of the crew, which is important. And when we get the information back, then we can start suggesting and working on routing, because each aircraft and each crew creates its own different set of problems.
And also, I would imagine, all the different rules and regulations of the various countries and nations that these aircraft have to fly through. How do you keep abreast, I suppose, of all that change?
Yeah, I mean, experience over the years, we can, off the top of our heads, rule out places or say you can go there or you can't go there. The main problems are always to do with fuel and range. If your aircraft can't reach the next Avgas airport, then we have to try and work an alternative route or even suggest ferry tanks and at the last have fuel moved to an airport if possible. But another big problem that's happening even more is more and more people want to fly their permit to fly aircraft long range.
Yeah.
And a lot of countries will not allow permit to fly aircraft into their airspace. Even helicopters have to have special permission because they're worried that they can land anywhere. And so it takes a lot of negotiation to get a permit for a helicopter. Nationalities, for some reason, some nationalities have problems in getting their visas. And when I mentioned the two Russian helicopters, I said they went to Morocco and one flew on to Mauritania. The other one had to stop because one of the crew members was from Belarus.
Right, okay.
And apparently Morocco doesn't allow Belarusians in. So they were grounded and had to wait until the other helicopter came back and then were thrown out the country to go towards the Canary Islands. And who would guess? You know, it's not something you know. You get a request from what you think are four Russian crew members saying, we want to go to Mauritania. Yeah, no problem. Oh, one aircraft's been grounded because the co-pilot's Belarusian.
Yeah. And what sort of complications spring up with things like insurances, and how does that work on those sorts of flights? Are there specialist companies? How does that work?
There are many insurance companies. There's one in Britain called Haywards, and they cater for long-range flights, and generally you pay for what you get, and you'll put down what countries you intend to fly through. And they're pretty good because if ever we do need to change a schedule, you can then ask for the insurance company to add a country. And a few places, Greenland, for instance, won't let you in unless you've got $1.5 million cover.
Yeah.
Just because of the cost of sending out air sea rescue. But we've not had anybody have any problems getting insurance. We've had people saying, how do I get insurance? And we've got a list of insurance companies for them to approach. And, you know, it's like somebody who say, right, I want to do this, but how do I get insurance? Don't worry, here's a list of companies. Try them. They've arranged insurance for previous flights. So go to them first. I call it a service we do, but It's just passing on information, really.
How about, you know, we've talked about flight planning, we've talked about, you know, the various negotiations and insurances and things like that. Where does the dreaded health and safety and the risk assessment process kick in? Because I would imagine there's both the risks that you would suggest and advise the clients of, but there's also all the flying risks and all those sorts of things. Some of them you're probably not aware of.
It's multi-layered. We give people coming to us, we offer a list of survival equipment, dependent on where they're flying. If it's not over the ocean, then we leave out life raft and gumby suits. We also suggest they get a really good in-flight tracking system that allows in-flight messaging to us.
Yeah.
And we've used this.
What sort of systems are they?
These are satellite systems. The best one we have found is called InReach. It used to be called Dell'Orme InReach. It's now been bought up by Garmin. And this allows people on the ground to follow their track. It updates every minute. And it gives information of height, speed, direction. But it also allows the pilots to message us, or us to message the pilots. It's brilliant. I mean, today I was in reach. We call it in reaching. Peter in his helicopter. He forgot the name of the fuel company in Bari in Italy. I was able to pass that on. So because there were two fuel companies, and he couldn't remember which one he was supposed to go to. He also asked, "What's that island in my 12 o'clock that we're flying over?" And I got Google Earth out and went, "Oh, I forgot the name of it now, Olios or something." I says, "It's the legendary home of Calypso, the nymph that tempted Odysseus to stay there 10 years. He says, "Oh, brilliant." Well, I was doing that all the time with pilots, who, especially solo pilots, because they've got nobody to talk to.
What about the whole issue of, particularly over water? Looking through your Facebook page, there's a lot of singles, helicopters, you know, there's a lot of single fixed wing. That's challenging, particularly across the Med, isn't it? How are they getting across these aircraft?
The old adage is, the engine doesn't know you're over water.
Okay. I walked into that one, didn't I?
If you've got a well-maintained engine and you've done all your checks properly in that, then in theory, if you can fly from London to Edinburgh, it's the same as flying from Crete to Egypt. You know, it's when we had Norman in Greenland, he was waiting for another helicopter on a round-the-world flight to catch up with him, and it crashed in the Davis Strait. The pilot got out, but the helicopter sank with the life raft and everything still on board. All he had was his flare gun, which he used for 2 days to scare away polar bears. That was an adventure and a half.
Said very politely. I mean, Eddie, there's got to be a book in this, isn't there?
It's something people have said to me. Because nearly every flight has an adventure in it. I mean, to do any flight is adventurous, any long-range flight. But the pilots who do it are not professional pilots, in the sense that they're not ferry pilots. They don't fly their aircraft for a gain. They've just gone, "I fancy doing something big," and they'll do it. And because they don't do this thing for a living, they get up to all kinds of adventures, mainly on the ground. There's very few adventures that happen in the air, because they're all good pilots, and the aircraft nowadays are really spot on. So the stuff happens on the ground, and you've got to go to these places for it to happen, and it's all great fun in the end. I mean, any scary moments become talking points. Johan being arrested as a spy and questioned for 30 hours is now a great after-dinner talking point, you know. It's always great to be me or Ahmed being part of this, because we're the people they come to first. It's like, if something's going on, we'll get the message. There's something going on. You know, there's a policeman here with a gun. I haven't got a clue what he's saying. And then we get in touch with the handlers to translate, and all turns out well. I mean, we had one pilot delayed in Lucky Chogio, but they took the delay as an advantage to explore. And he was made a tribal chieftain.
I wasn't expecting that. I was going to ask you where that was in the world, but
it's Kenya.
Well, Eddie, as we sort of get towards the end of our chat, this is a tricky one. They're all pretty amazing, these flights, but most memorable one for you?
It's got to be Norman Surplus, mainly because it took 5 years.
Right.
And I was involved for 5 years, solely involved for the last leg from Oregon to Ireland. But
and what was he flying?
MT-03 autogyro, open cockpit.
Goodness me. This is around the world. So that last step across the pond, how did he make that?
None of it in northern Canada across to Greenland, around the coast of Greenland to Kulusuk, where it's about 400 nautical miles across the Arctic Ocean to Iceland. Then from Reykjavik to Egilsstaðir in the east of Iceland for the 300 nautical mile hop to the Faroe Islands. And
in an auto gyro. In an open cockpit auto gyro. Right.
I mean, Norman was a cancer survivor. He had bowel cancer and was not given long to live, but he survived it. And he thought, well, what shall I do? So he learned to fly an autogyro, and bought an autogyro and decided to go around the world campaigning for more up in the profile of bowel cancer.
Wow. What a fantastic man.
Yeah. And he arrived back in August 2015 on the playing fields at Larne in Northern Ireland. No airport for him. He landed between the rugby posts. And a week later, I met up with him at the LAA rally.
So, amazing.
So he was our first customer in Cairo, and it was 5 years again before I met him again. So, but we've become great friends over the intervening period.
And that seems to be the thing, Eddie, you know, as I say, been watching your social media feeds, talking to you, hearing some of the stories. It's almost more about the people than it is about the aeroplanes.
Yeah, I find that because although the common factor is aviation and aircraft, and especially general aviation, meeting the pilots, whether in face-to-face or by email or different chat options, it's kind of like you get to know people, they get to know you, and they're happy to share their adventure with you because I think they can sense how much we are enjoying it. And of course, when they do come to Cairo and I get to meet them, put their aircraft in the hangar, and then the adventure really starts. They get to meet the Egyptians, people who around the world who are not from this region may be wary of, but go away thinking they are some of the nicest people I've ever met.
Yeah.
And hospitable. And of course, you get to meet our camel.
Now, I'm looking at your picture and I'm seeing a camel kiss you. I presume that's your camel.
Yeah, he's called Charlie Brown. I bought him.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I don't quite know where to go with this line of questioning, but he certainly looks very cute. So we'll park Charlie Brown there for a moment, and sadly we're going to wrap up now, Eddie.
Yeah, that's great.
Where can we find out more about you, Ahmed, and the team at GASE?
We're most active on Facebook, as you know, because we run the stories of the different adventure flights, and you can find at www.facebook.com/aviationegypt.
Really is a great feed. It's quite inspirational. Everyone on there seems very happy. You know, you see some great aircraft. And the one thing I would say is you can't see it from a photo, but they all look really well maintained and really well cared for. So there's some great stuff to see. So yeah, I would recommend that. And how about your website?
Just for the Facebook page, can I ask people if they go there to check out the photo albums? Because each major flight around the world, Africa and back, has their own album of photos in our album section. For our website, which also has the contact us option, is www.gasupportegypt.com.
Well, it's been an amazing journey, Eddie, from Hampshire to Liverpool to Egypt to all around the globe. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing some of that.
It's been my pleasure, and I now know this thing about the book. I've only touched the tip of the iceberg with the stories, and it's like, I've got to be able to tell them eventually. So it's thank you for offering that idea. But it's been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you for contacting us.
No, we've really enjoyed it. So we're going to leave GASE there. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. Now, you can find Extended on Stitcher.com, UKpodcast.com, the Pod Directory, and of course iTunes. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on the website, so please do ask before using anything you hear. This programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. And with the music, it's goodbye from Eddie Gold.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Extended!
This is XTP Media.